Of you as a Yankee, anyway. She was right. During the Civil War, he served the Union forces by treating injured soldiers. After the Confederates surrendered, and for reasons that remain unclear, local Union officers arrested Martha Gibbs and locked her up in the Black Folks' Church, where they kept her under constant guard for 3 days, fed her hardtack and water, and then released her. After the soldiers set her free, Gibbs freed her slaves, but only temporarily. One day, when her husband had gone to buy corn for his livestock, she gathered up some of her slaves, 10 6-mule wagons and 1 ox-cook wagon, and set off with them. They walked about 215 miles from Vicksburg, Mississippi, to about 3 miles from Marshall, Texas. She hired Irishman guards with rifles to make sure that none of her freed slaves ran away during the journey, and when they stopped to rest, the guards tied the men to trees. Then, on June 19, 1866, 1 year after these legally free but still enslaved people made her first crop in Texas, Martha Gibbs finally let them go. Married slave-owning women like Martha Gibbs have received scant attention in historical scholarship. Historians have acknowledged that some Southern women owned slaves, but they usually focus on the wealthiest single or widowed women. When they do encounter married slave-owning women in 19th-century records, they generally assume that the women's legal status as wives prevented them from owning slaves in their own right. Historians rarely differentiate between married women who owned enslaved people in their own right and married women who merely lived in households in which they engaged with, managed, and benefited from the labor of the enslaved people that others owned. Historians rarely consider why slave ownership might have mattered to the women in question, to the enslaved people they owned, to slaveholding communities, to the institution of slavery, or, more broadly, to the region. Historians have neglected these women because their behaviors toward and relationships with their slaves do not conform to prevailing ideas about white women and slave mastery. While it has long been recognized that Southern slave owners were in the minority, and that they were by no means a homogeneous group, so much of what scholars know about women in the slaveholding South draws upon the diaries or letters of the most elite, those living in households that owned more than 10 enslaved people. Historians have chronicled these lives, producing microhistories about an extremely small subset of an already small group of white Southerners. Such studies should not be used to make generalizations about the majority of women in slaveholding communities at large. Records indicate that the majority of slave owners owned 10 enslaved people or less. Scholars who examine the authority that women held over their slaves frequently focus on the women's obligatory rather than voluntary or self-initiated management and discipline of enslaved people. They argue that women could not be true masters of slaves, rather they were fictive masters. Even when they possessed the skills and the gall to manage their slaves, these historians argue, they typically did not relish their power. They did not view their activities as slave mastery, and neither did Southern laws and courts. This was especially true when it came to violent forms of discipline. White women might punish enslaved people, they might even be brutal and sadistic, but they fell short of wielding a master's power. In sum, these scholars argue that slave-owning women's acts of violence differed from those of slave-owning men. By extension, many of these scholars flatly reject the idea that white married women could adeptly manage enslaved people without the assistance of men, be they white or black, or that, aside from a few exceptional women, they could possess the acumen to do so while also effectively running plantations. Married women, they argue, begrudgingly assumed roles as deputy husbands and fictive widows when their husbands were away. When their men were present, these women happily and enthusiastically relinquished such responsibilities and exhorted their men to handle what one historian has called a man's business. And in the view of more than a few historians of American slavery and the domestic slave trade, this was especially the case when it came to the business of buying, selling, and even hiring enslaved people. These scholars claim that the nasty and unseemly business of transacting for human beings was considered ill-suited to white ladies. In They Were Her Property, I build upon these earlier studies, but I also depart from them in significant ways.